Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Okay, please be seated. We are here for our second case this morning, and it is State versus Percy Robinson, 20 AP 1728 CR. Before we proceed on that case, though, and before I ask for counsel's appearances, I just want to note that New Glarus High School is here. If you could stand up, we'd like to just say hello to you.
Great.
Nice to have you here today. You had a decent travel day, so that's good. Hopefully you enjoy your time with us. And later, if you have time, Justice Krofsky will come out and spend a few minutes with you. You can ask her any questions you like.
We're going to talk about that bakery in New Glarus. It's got the best bakery.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to New Glarus.
Fair enough.
A lot. So you might spend the entire time talking about things like bakery and libation, maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe not. All right. Go ahead and have a seat. Went back to State versus Robinson. Could I please have counsel's appearance?
Speak up. I can't hear you, please.
Thanks. All right. Good morning. 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, go ahead and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. 2008, the United States Supreme Court examined whether a so-called Riverside procedure, specifically a Texas procedure, which, as we'll discuss today, is substantially identical to Wisconsin CR 215. The court was examining whether that probable cause hearing could trigger the attachment of the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Applying decades of well-settled precedent, the court wasted no time in answering in the affirmative for three reasons. Number one, the process involves the filing of a formal accusation by an agent of the state. Number two, a judicial officer reviews that accusation, makes a probable cause determination. In other words, a judicial officer determines whether the arrested person probably committed the crime for which they have been arrested. And number three, the judicial officer sets bail, meant to ensure that the presently incarcerated individual remains available for an ongoing prosecution. Those three elements are present in Wisconsin CR 215, and because the authority we've been discussing, Roth-Gary, predated Mr. Robinson's trial by roughly a decade, reasonably competent counsel, acting under prevailing professional norms, had an obligation to avail himself of that authority and exclude the highly important to the state out-of-court identification of his client.
Counsel, is it your position that all Riverside hearings, the right to counsel attaches to them? Maybe you could ferret out a little bit when you think it attaches and when it doesn't, when there's some Riverside hearing slash proceeding.
So my answer to that would be the three characteristics that the court identified in Roth-Gary. That's the filing of the formal accusation, the probable cause review, and the setting of bail.
So if there's a Riverside hearing and bail is not set,
so
then where are we?
So, yes, my understanding under Riverside is the court is not obligated to set bail as part of the Riverside proceeding. And I think in that circumstance, at least under Roth-Gary, which establishes if you have these three things, you have attachment. Arguably, you do not have attachment under Roth-Gary. Now, whether that holding could be revisited or not, I don't know. It's not really relevant to this case, because what we have in Roth-Gary is the court saying, if you have these three things, you have attachment. We have those three things present in Wisconsin's CR 215 procedure.
under your logic, a lineup can never occur until after someone makes a formal appearance in court, obtains counsel, and then the formal proceedings have occurred.
So my position is that if someone has gone through this procedure, the CR-215, then following Kirby and the other cases cited in the brief, an in-person lineup would be considered a critical phase, and the person would be entitled to counsel.
You might be entitled to counsel, but can counsel say my client's not participating in a lineup?
I am... frankly, I'm unsure whether counsel could refuse on his client's behalf. I don't really know that that is relevant to the attachment inquiry.
I'm just trying to figure out the reality on the ground. So bank robbery happens on a Friday. Someone is arrested. There isn't a show up at the scene. The person's found a few hours later, taken into custody within the time period outlined by Riverside. A court makes a judicial determination that they're properly being held. Under your logic, there's no way to do a lineup until Monday or whenever they come into court, have their initial appearance, and counsel is assigned to the case, right? Because counsel would have to be assigned to the case. So no lineup can occur until counsel is assigned to the case, right?
Well, I think two things. I think the question somewhat conflates these procedures. I think when we're discussing initial appearance under kind of Wisconsin criminal procedure versus quote-unquote initial appearance.
Well, you don't get a lawyer on a Riverside review.
Correct.
So
they're not.
I'm just trying to figure out what that means. It's not a hard question. I'm not trying to make it a hard question. I'm trying to figure out the reality. I think, under your logic,
lineups
cannot occur and unless and until either a court appoints a lawyer, the person hires a lawyer, or the public defender assigns a lawyer.
So the person would have a right to a lawyer if they've been through this procedure. So, yes, they would need to have a lawyer present. Or I suppose affirmatively waive counsel, that might be an option, but presumably they need a lawyer present because that is what the United States Supreme Court precedent tells us. I don't know logistically, practically, you know, the effectuation of that. We're here to determine what the Supreme Court precedents say. They're quite clear. You go through these procedures, you have these three elements that are met.
I know, you keep going back to that. I'm just trying to get sort of a realistic way of how this would work. And I think the answer is, yeah, lineups can't happen until the lawyer is going to be present for it.
I think that's correct.
In Rothgerry or Rothgerry, not sure, the procedure is in Texas, right? And the defendant or the suspect in that case is present for the hearing, and here in the Milwaukee situation, they do not bring the suspect to the hearing. Does that matter?
So I think when we look at the court's holding in Rothgerry, the court's clear that it's these three requirements that I've mentioned previously that are dispositive to its holding. I think footnote 9 of Rothgerry sets it out, is whether there's been this formal accusation which has prompted the judicial officer to take action in response. I know the state wants to focus on this idea of a personal appearance almost as if there's a fourth requirement present in Rothgerry. I just don't think that the text of Rothgerry supports that, and not only that, but contrary to kind of the thrust and some of the discussion, Gary, where the court was very clear that it did not want to make the decision of when constitutional rights attach dependent upon the nuances, the quirks of local jurisdictional practice, acknowledging that we have thousands of jurisdictions. They are licensed by virtue of the language in Riverside to experiment with differing pretrial procedures. What the court wanted to do was to identify those core general components that need to be satisfied And so I think if we're going to adopt the state's position that this person physically walking into the courtroom somehow matters, I think that we are in that universe that Justice Souter warned us about when suddenly the court does become, quote unquote, this was his word, bogged down in these factual disputes that really aren't material, because after all, what we're talking about is, has the state made a formal accusation against someone? Has there been a judicial action in response, a probable cause hearing, and has the court decided to impose bail against that defendant? And if those three things are met, we have attachment.
I have a couple questions. One is, do you think that there is any type of notice requirement? Because in Rothjerry, of course, if the suspect is there, the suspect will get notice, right, of what the bail is and what the formal accusations are. In the CR-215 procedure, it is a little less clear to me. So I guess my first question is there notice? Do you think there's a notice requirement, number one? And number two, if there is, then how in the – there's no notice in the CR-215 procedure, is there?
So I think, number one, the court in Rothjerry does use terminology like the person being informed of the accusation. And so I think that there is a component of the person being informed, being noticed about what's happening with this procedure. I would agree with that. In the CR-215, if we look at the court form, it's distributed to the person. So the person does get notice. They're copied on this paper.
And do we know that is it in the record? Did Mr. Robinson get notice in this case?
What we have is the CR-215 form, which includes him as the defendant on the circulation list. I think we can assume from that, unless we're going to attribute that Milwaukee County did not follow its procedures, that he would have gotten notice. I think also it's implicit within
Is that Milwaukee County's procedure? The reason I'm asking is because the CR-215, of course, is a state form, right?
That's correct.
And so having the form be a state form is different than what Milwaukee's procedures are. So I just want to know, does the record tell us that that is what Milwaukee does? I understand that it's in, like, the form is triplicate or quadruplicate or whatever, but is that in fact, do we know that that's in fact what Milwaukee's procedure is?
So I think Milwaukee's procedure is to do this all paper procedure, and I think that's discussed in the certification opinion as well as the unpublished Garcia decision, and it's discussed in those citable and persuasive federal district court decisions that I included. That's really, I think, what makes Milwaukee somewhat unique. They have decided to do this procedure entirely on paper. This kind of gets at the argument that I was making, the hypothetical that I was explaining in my brief, wherein I think why it's problematic to focus and make that dispositive is how similarly situated individuals, if that becomes the dispositive criteria, obtain constitutional rights in a somewhat arbitrary and inconsistent fashion.
So I'm not so certain that Milwaukee's procedure is unique. The only experience I have is in Dane County, right? And I was both a deputy DA, so I would show up. I would sometimes look at the PC forms, but certainly as a judge, I would do it. And it's all on paper here as well. I think in your brief, or perhaps it's a state brief, talk about the procedure in Ozaukee County, but I don't know how unique it is not to have defendants show up. I know we'd have two counties for sure in the state where that is happening.
And I think the reason why it's probably not so unique is if we look at this court's decision in Koch, this court explicitly authorized the figurative appearance of individuals for the purpose of Riverside hearings. So we have Riverside, which has a very clear directive, which tells us the person, quote unquote, brought before the magistrate. In State versus Koch, this court had no difficulty indicating, well, brought before doesn't really mean that you're physically brought before. You can be figuratively brought before. And that's what at least Milwaukee, Dane County as well, have utilized. And my point being, it shouldn't matter for the purpose of the constitutional analysis whether the jailers in whatever county take the 5 minutes to walk the defendant from one place to the other to be handed a piece of paper. I think if that's what we're going to hold is dispositive as to when constitutional rights attach, we are squarely in the problematic situation that the court, Justice Souter, writing for the majority, was discussing in Roth-Gary, where we have then wedded these constitutional rights to these exceedingly specific jurisdiction by jurisdiction specific practices. And I think a fair question for the state would be, okay, state, you indicate that a personal appearance is required. What kind of personal appearance for the purpose of satisfying or attaching the Sixth Amendment do you want? Does it have to be the person comes into court and is seated at a counsel table, it looks like a court hearing? Does it have to be that the person sits in the jury box in a mass appearance? Can it be that the person appears by video, et cetera? I think that requirement inevitably sets us on that fact-specific inquiry, and that's specifically in Roth-Gary what the court rejected and said, we're not going to get bogged down in that. We're setting out these specific general requirements. There's three of them, and if you satisfy those three things, right to counsel has attached.
I don't think Roth-Gary is as clear as you're suggesting, and in your case, we are in the mode of determining whether counsel is ineffective. And I know you want us to answer the question that was left unanswered by this court, which was equally divided in Garcia. But the problem with Roth-Gary, for your purposes, that the defendant was at the hearing, and so the rule that the court developed in that case was presumed that the defendant is there, not the case in your case. And so given that the law is unsettled and there are different, I think, reasonable interpretations or applications of Roth-Gary to this situation with the CR 215, why should we answer this question? Because I think you'd concede we don't have to answer the question since the law is unsettled. That means that counsel can't be ineffective for failing to raise the Sixth Amendment issue.
So, first of all, I disagree. I don't think that the law is unsettled. I think Roth-Gary was quite clear when it analyzed a procedure substantially identical to Wisconsin's procedure and indicated that what matters for purposes of attachment is that filing of the formal accusation occasioned by those judicial actions in response, the probable cause analysis, and the setting of bail. At no point in the text of Roth-Gary did the Supreme Court hold that it is a dispositive requirement that the defendant physically appear. And as I've been articulating this morning, I think inferring or implying or attributing that holding to the court is erroneous because, again, the court was specifically declining to adopt very granular, specific ideas about attachment. It said that the court wanted to construct very general requirements, and it articulated those three requirements.
But in the very first paragraph of the opinion, the court said that it had already held the right to counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment applies at the first appearance before a judicial officer, and then it teed up a very narrow question it was deciding. The question here is whether attachment of the right also requires that a public prosecutor be aware of the initial proceeding or involved in its conduct, and the court held it does not. So it seems to me to be a narrow holding, and we're dealing with a different situation here because your client did not make an appearance before a judicial officer. So I understand that on the merits, you're arguing that Roth-Gary reasonably applied should mean that that attachment occurred of the right. But given that Roth-Gary was dealing with a different issue than in your case, I'm struggling to see how we could deem defense counsel to be ineffective for not raising it.
So, again, I don't think that Roth-Gary is addressing such a narrow or discreet or different question. I think the court is clear that it's, you know, it's the initial appearance which is occasioned by the filing of the formal accusation and these judicial actions in a response. Initial appearance for the purpose of this Riverside hearing, no, based on binding precedent in this state, does not mean an in-person appearance. We already know that. That's already settled law, that the person does not have to formally appear. The person can figuratively appear. And we're completely comfortable with that, have been comfortable with that for several decades. So I think when we look at Strickland, which is what we have to go back to when we're assessing deficient performance, we have to start there with the text of Strickland. When the court was asked to come up with a definition of deficient performance, the court was very clear that it was saying, quote, simply reasonableness under prevailing professional norms. I do not think it is uncontroversial to assert that reasonably competent counsel under prevailing professional defense norms should understand the application of this case, which again predates Mr. Robinson's prosecution by a decade, addresses a nearly identical procedure, and clearly compels that the most important evidence in the case against his client is not admissible. I don't see how that is reasonable for counsel to then ignore that or omit consideration of that.
Mr. Audis, I hear you. I got to tell you, I went down several rabbit holes preparing for this case today because I find this really confusing. I'm not really sure where the law is on this. So when I read Rothgary, this is a sentence that I'm really struggling with. It says, an accusation filed with a judicial officer is sufficiently formal. These are the requirements, okay? An accusation filed with a judicial officer is sufficiently formal. So we're saying that the CR 215, or you want us to say the CR 215, is an accusation filed with a judicial officer that's sufficiently formal. Second, the government's commitment to prosecute is sufficiently concrete. To prosecute. So, and then the third, it says, when the accusation prompts arraignment and restrictions on the accused liberty to facilitate the prosecution. If bail is set, which is what you've said, then I don't really have an issue with the third phrase. But I really am struggling with the government's commitment to prosecute is sufficiently concrete because we're not at a stage where an information or a complaint is being filed. The form simply lists out whatever charges the person was arrested for. This hasn't gone to the DA. And so how do we know based that the CR 215 indicates this sufficiently concrete commitment to prosecute by the government?
So I think it's, first of all, I think it's worth noting that both Rothgary and this case involve probable cause affidavits for the purpose of herbicide. Okay? I think also we should look specifically at the language in Rothgary. I'm looking at the discussion in the U.S. reports, page 2590, the paragraph beginning, the county also tries to downplay the significance, that paragraph, where the United States Supreme Court already addressed and rejected an identical argument in Rothgary, because the state of Texas tried to make this argument that, hey, this is just an accusation to kick off a probable cause proceeding. The prosecutor's not aware of it. Are you really going to say that we're committed to prosecute every time that this happens? And the court said, look, we acknowledge that, you know, if we use an analogy, that if this is a train track and it's heading towards trial, we acknowledge that at some point in the future, maybe at the grand jury stage, or maybe at some other stage, a prosecutor could intervene and stop the train, right? But what we're asking is, has the train left the station? That's the question that we're asking. Has the machinery been activated? And the court was clear that the probable cause affidavit in Texas did that, regardless of whether some prosecutor could get involved down the road and at the grand jury stage, maybe the prosecution doesn't go any further. We know that even if we adopt the state's position, which I think is completely untenable, that it's only the complaint that matters for initiating the prosecution. Filing of a complaint doesn't bind a prosecutor in that strict way either. The prosecutor can always make a decision to dismiss.
But at least it comes from the prosecutor. That's where I'm really struggling, is that you're Your argument is that the prosecutorial train has left the station, even though no prosecutor is on the train?
Because, yes, because that is the question that Rothgary directly answered. Because in that case, just like in Wisconsin, we had a police officer filing a probable cause affidavit to commence this procedure, and the state of Texas said, hold on, there's not a prosecutor involved. A prosecutor could get involved down the road and make a different decision.
I agree with you, but in that same paragraph you just cited, the court also said a defendant subject to accusation after initial appearance is, so to speak, on the train, is headed for trial and needs to get a lawyer working. So it seemed that the initial appearance was of significance to the court in Rothgary.
So, again, initial appearance, I think, is a term of art. And I think we need to be careful about that because differing jurisdictions can use initial appearance in different ways. I don't think we're talking about initial appearance in the Wisconsin criminal procedure sense of initial appearance. We're talking about that initial appearance being when the judicial officer becomes involved, when that accusation is forwarded to that judicial officer, and when, in the case of this pain, the person makes this figurative appearance where there's this finding that this person, yes, you have probably committed the crime for which you have been arrested.
Does Riverside,
so is every, go ahead, Chief.
Does Riverside exist anymore then? I mean, if someone isn't arrested on a warrant and it's a warrantless arrest and it's a Friday, when would a judge need to conduct a Riverside review, or do we need to have courthouses around the state open up on the weekends to have initial appearances under that logic?
So, again, I think this is a conflation of the Riverside hearing is the initial appearance for the purpose of satisfying the Sixth Amendment attachment inquiry. It's not saying that there is another initial appearance for the purpose of determining when the Sixth Amendment attaches.
Really? I used to review documents over the weekends, or if it's a holiday weekend, you have to make sure people aren't being held for many, many days without some sort of review as to whether they're being properly held. That was not an initial appearance.
If I may answer?
Yeah.
So it is a Riverside hearing. That's a requirement. Riverside is not going to go away by virtue of siding with me. It's just acknowledging, as the court did in Rothgary, that Riverside probable cause hearing, when it has the additional component of the setting of bail, that is an initial appearance for the purpose of triggering the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Wisconsin may provide, under its criminal procedure statutes, another procedure called an initial appearance later on. This is not substituting or replacing that, acknowledging for the purposes of federal constitutional law, this is the quote-unquote initial appearance.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, good morning.
So judicial review on paper of whether someone's being appropriately held on, let's just make it easy, a long holiday weekend, is now an initial appearance?
I don't think so, no. So the way that I read Rothgary is, and the cases that preceded, I guess, I would start with the very first sentence of the Rothgary opinion. The court says this: this court has held that the right to counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment applies at the first appearance before a judicial officer, at which a defendant is told of the formal accusation against him and restrictions are imposed on his liberty. The court then goes on to conclude that in that framework, there's nothing about prosecutorial knowledge, prosecutorial notice. That's the entire thrust of Rothgary. But it's looking at for those three things in order to determine whether the Sixth Amendment right to counsel has attached. Now, looking back at Brewer and Jackson and Kirby, the cases sort of underpinning Rothgary, those cases talk about a variety of ways that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel can attach. And I want to say that I don't think there's only one way for the Sixth Amendment right to counsel to attach. I think If a formal criminal complaint is filed, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel can attach. And what Rothgary does is it explains, even in the absence of a state's formal criminal complaint, you can have a procedure that causes the Sixth Amendment right to counsel to attach if it is the first appearance before a judicial officer where the defendant is told of the formal accusation against him and restrictions are imposed on his liberty. So my answer to your question, Chief Justice, is that no, I don't think that the use of Form CR 215 triggers the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. I don't think it qualifies as an initial appearance because it doesn't meet those criteria.
But you're saying you think the person has to physically appear in front of a magistrate, and that is not what Rothgary says.
So
how do you get around that in your thinking about this?
So in terms of body in the courtroom, no. I don't think body in the courtroom is required. I would look at the initial appearance statute. And the initial appearance statute...
In Wisconsin. Okay, but that's neither here nor there, and this is where maybe there's some confusion. The word initial appearance is when the Supreme Court talked about initial appearance, they weren't using our definition of initial appearance. So why does it matter what our statute says? We have a process being used in Milwaukee County whereby people are brought in, they do a Riverside hearing, it's reviewed for probable cause, bail is set, and then they can be held, and they are held. And the question isn't whether they need an attorney that minute, because they don't. The question is if there is then subsequent to that time, one of these, what is it called, the proceeding, critical proceeding after that, then they're entitled to it. So it may not affect anything if they're sitting there and sitting there and sitting there, but if someone wants to do a lineup 6 days later and they're still sitting there because they haven't posted bail and they haven't gotten into court yet, because in Milwaukee County you don't get in right away for an initial appearance, what we call an initial appearance. If the lineup wants to be conducted, do they have a right to have an attorney?
Right. So Rothgary, when I went through Rothgary, I counted at least 14 times when the court used initial appearance, first appearance, something along those lines. I don't think you can read Rothgary and say that there is no significance to initial appearance. The question is, what does that mean? I acknowledge.
What does it mean if you don't have to be in person? Right?
So I acknowledge that it's not referring to Wisconsin law. It's not referring to 970.01 or the initial appearance statute. But I think when you look at what constitutes, you know, whether it's a term of art or not, what constitutes a first appearance, an initial appearance in court, I think it needs to be more than the first appearance of a set of facts crossing the desk of a magistrate. I think there needs to be some involvement by the accused in order for it to be a first appearance.
And so how would that look if you weren't in person? Isn't the distribution of the form, I mean, the person, isn't that enough? I mean, how would it look other than being in person based on what you're saying?
Well, I go back to the initial appearance statute, which allows appearances to occur either by telephone or AV, like teleconferencing.
Okay, so, but that's like being in person. So you're saying it has to be in person.
Effectively, yes. But like
even
I said,
though Rothgary doesn't say that.
I think that Rothgary at least suggested it. Rothgary doesn't go and hit that nail directly on the head because that wasn't the question in Rothgary. Rothgary was solely looking at prosecutorial involvement.
So the way the state would get around this then would just be to do what they're doing in Milwaukee County. And if they want to have a lineup, they better not be bringing that person in, and they should just keep doing what they're doing. Whereas other places that bring the person in for the CR 215 or do a quick initial appearance in front of a magistrate of some kind, those cases they would get their Sixth Amendment right. How do you reconcile that?
So a couple answers, I'd say. First of all, in terms of variation between counties, there's this idea that, well, you can't have different constitutional rights in different counties. And I would say it's not a different constitutional right. It's the same constitutional right. Certain procedures can cause it to attach and certain cannot. And if there's a difference between Milwaukee County and Ozaukee County, that's really no different than if there's a difference between Kenosha and Waukegan or Beloit and South Beloit or Hudson and St. Paul. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the states can have different procedures for this, and that's perfectly fine. So for an argument that the counties can't have
Well, it's not so much about having different procedures. Isn't it about wanting your cake and eating it too? I mean, you want to be able to do what you want to do despite the potential of the Sixth Amendment attaching. I mean, this gives you the ability as the state to really operate in a realm where you can avoid attachment of the Sixth Amendment.
So,
I mean, you can avoid it. All you got to do is not bring them into court.
I don't think it's quite so nefarious as all of that. I think it's an understanding of the rules and then complying with them. I think maybe an example would be if law enforcement, a sheriff's department or something like that, has a set of procedures designed to ensure that their questioning of a suspect doesn't become a custodial interrogation. They're not necessarily getting around anything. It's just that the Miranda rights don't need to be read because it's not a custodial interrogation. So, it's understanding the rules, it's complying with them, and that should be encouraged. But I don't see it as, and I guess I would also point out that in Kirby, the court was asked if, essentially, if there was a right to counsel before the at a lineup before the Sixth Amendment right to counsel had attached, and they basically said, we have said that a live in-person lineup is a critical stage of a prosecution, but if the prosecution hasn't commenced, it's not a critical stage. You don't get an attorney there. So there's not this huge concern that the state is somehow getting around this requirement that there should be an attorney at every single lineup. It's really more of an administrative question at that point as to whether SPD or whoever has appointed an attorney.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about, this wasn't briefed, but I'm just curious if you have an answer to this question to help me understand, but 96901 talks about the setting of bail, the statute. And it says that, with some exceptions, they can be released, but bail may be imposed at or after the initial appearance, only upon a finding of court that there's a reasonable basis to believe that bail is necessary to assure appearance in court. So I'm curious, and maybe there's things I don't understand, but how is it that Milwaukee has authority to set bail without an initial appearance? Seems that runs directly contrary to the language of the statute.
That is an interesting question, and because it's not in the briefing, it's not something I had considered.
I won't ask you to answer something you haven't briefed.
I guess what I would say more broadly about the setting of bail and how it fits into this whole equation is that Rothgary talks about restrictions on liberty more so than the setting of bail. It talks about that in the context of Brewer and Jackson and those other cases. And so I think that to the extent that we're looking at the fact that bail is set in Milwaukee County, whereas some counties might not choose to use the form to set bail, the real question comes down to a restriction on liberty. Now, how that all fits in is, I think, if a county elects not to set bail, there is still a restriction on liberty, because if it's a felony, they're likely going to be held without bail until the initial appearance or a bail hearing can be done. If it's a misdemeanor offense, they're likely going to be subject to whatever the county's misdemeanor bail schedule is for release. So unless there's an absolute release, you still have this restriction on liberty. Where that lands us is that you're always going to have a restriction on liberty. It's not it's sort of this ephemeral requirement, because there's always going to be some kind of restriction on liberty. So if you're saying basically restriction on liberty plus probable cause finding, you get into a world where the Riverside hearing is effectively always going to result in the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaching. And I don't think that's what the U.S. Supreme Court was going for. I think they would have written a very different opinion. Now,
quick other question I just wanted to ask about. Obviously there's this case, the Garcia case before the Seventh Circuit. Arguments have been had in that case. Do you want us to answer this question right now? I have some concern about us as a court issuing substantive guidance on a question in a way that might be in tension with or conflict with an opinion of the Seventh Circuit, which could come any day, could not, who knows,
right?
But thinking about those who need to make decisions about how to actually operate I'm curious if the state has any position on that.
So I actually argued Garcia in the Seventh Circuit this spring. I've been waiting for it to come out. I was terrified it was going to come out this morning. It didn't.
That would have been great. We could have asked you about
it. It would have made things interesting. I give you that. To answer your question directly, yes, I do think the state wants an answer on this question. More broadly, I am not certain, so Garcia is a habeas case, and it's got right. Section 2254 and a particular set of rules. I don't think, of course I don't know, but I don't think that the Garcia opinion is likely to answer the question directly. I think it's going to answer it through the context of whether the Court of Appeals decision in Garcia was an unreasonable application. And I don't think that gets us to where we need to be to really tell jurisdictions where to go with this question. So I do think an answer, a clear answer, even though it's not required, as Justice Rebecca Bradley, you were saying, it's not required to answer the ineffective assistance of counsel question. I do think it would be beneficial, particularly with the case here on certification from the Court of Appeals, to get a clear answer on it.
I would like you to tell me where you think the line is then, because in my reading of the briefs and some of the cases, I started to end up where Justice Hagedorn was, where I'm not understanding. I feel like somehow you could look at this and Riverside could be completely subsumed by Rothgerry. And you have in your brief on page 28, you say the circuit court found two things. The signing of the CR 215 does not create a criminal court case file, and I'm on the bottom of 28 of your brief, and the review of the CR 215 form does not bind the prosecutor to issue any charges. These specific factual findings foreclose Robinson's argument that the CR 215 form is the legal equivalent of a formal charge. Now, I don't hear them talking about formal charges. Maybe they are. I can't figure out where the line is between Rothgerry and Riverside. I can't figure out if we need the requirement of a criminal case file or a DA issuing charges. I didn't think we need that. Where are we on the train? I'm like, I need a Google map.
So I think this goes back to the idea that there are multiple ways that you can get to the attachment of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And one of them is by having, I think the Brewer talks about, in indictment or information or formal complaint. And I think the point is that the CR 215, the charges listed on the CR 215 are not sufficient standing alone to rise to the level of a criminal complaint. That said, I do think Rothgerry acknowledges that there are other ways that you can get to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaching. And to get to that, that's where then you say, okay, if there's no formal complaint, then what do we need? Well, we need a charge, and we can dispute whether this is a formal enough charge. But then we also need the defendant or the accused to be told of the charge in his first appearance in court, and then restrictions placed on his liberty in order to get there without the formal complaint. And I don't think that the use of Form CR 215 accomplishes all of that because there is no in-person appearance and because the accused is not told of the charge against him. Now, to address your question to Mr. August, Justice Dowd, about the form being routed to him, or it might have been Justice Crosby's question. I apologize. But,
I'm taller.
It was from that end of the bench.
So to
address that question, one of the Supreme Court's concerns in Rothgerry with prosecutorial knowledge or prosecutorial involvement being the standard is that it's wholly unworkable because there's just no way that we're going to know when the prosecutor actually got involved, when the prosecutor stepped in. They said that's not a workable standard, so we're not going to use it. And I would submit that the same is true for a form that is routed to the defendant. We don't know when he got it. It could be 10 minutes later if the jailer walks it straight down to him. It could be 5 days if it goes through prison mail. We have...
So you're putting on the requirements on the three that Mr. August gave us. You're putting on another one of notice, that it doesn't attach until they got notice.
So I disagree with his characterization of the three requirements. I go back to the first sentence in Rothgerry, and I look at the in-person appearance notice of the charges and restrictions on liberty. I do think that notice to the defendant, I don't think it's sort of in addition to his characterization, but Rothgary talks a lot about notice to the defendant, and I do think that if the defendant isn't being notified, then it hasn't attached. And so then we end up in this place where we have this sort of legal fallacy of, well, the form has been signed and eventually the defendant is going to get it, so therefore we'll presume that he has gotten it now. Or you end up in a place where you have to really do this fact-finding, get bogged down in the facts to conclude when the defendant actually received the form and was notified. Otherwise, you're reading that notification requirement out.
Well, counsel, that seems to me to have an abundance of concerns. An easy one is that there is no incentive to turn, despite what the form says, no incentive to deliver it to the defendant, because who wants the hassle of counsel attaching? You know, so is it a week? Is it 3 days? Is it 7 days? Who knows? I mean, there's something wrong with the idea of you placing the burden someplace else, but that hasn't been briefed and argued. I want to get to what has been briefed before us, and that is, when I look at Rothgary and the what's sufficient enough in terms of the charges, and we've referred earlier in argument to these paragraphs. Attachment occurs, says Rothgary, when the government has used the judicial machinery to signal a commitment to prosecute. You know, and I, as soon as I read that, I say, ooh, signal, that's an important word, right? And Rothgary tells us what you need to signal, and that is that it's not immutable. That is, you know, the state may rethink its commitment at any point. It may choose not to seek the indictment. It may choose something different, going to the framework of the train leaving the station that has been raised by one of my colleagues. Rothgary was prescient and said, but without a change in position, a defendant subject to accusation after initial appearance is headed, that's the train, for trial and needs to get a lawyer. It doesn't seem to me you need a formal complaint. Do you?
No. I agree. A formal complaint is one way to get to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaching. It is not the only way.
And is your position that, however, if for counsel to attach, you do need physical presence, whether it's via the telephone or something? Is that your position?
I think that in the absence of a formal complaint, and in the absence of any other case law from the United States Supreme Court, we're left with what they gave us in Brewer and Jackson and Kirby, and that is the sentence that begins the Rothgary opinion, where they talk about the initial appearance where he's accused, informed of the accusations against him, and restrictions are placed on his liberty. I think to go beyond that, is there some, you know, theoretical way in which counsel could attach without those things? I suppose there could be. I'm not aware of any case that sort of shows another avenue besides the initial appearance or the criminal complaint. And so, and I'm not understanding Mr. Robinson's brief to argue.
One of my concerns is not to hear the words initial appearance and use that superimpose what I've always understood an initial appearance to be in the state of Wisconsin. But you refer to the first sentence. The first sentence doesn't say initial appearance. It says at the first appearance, right?
Right.
Before a judicial officer.
Right.
Why is this not a first appearance?
Because there's been no appearance at this point.
Okay, so it all boils down to the physical requirement then for you.
Well, again, I think it's the involvement of the suspect himself. You know, and whether we talk about physical presence in the courtroom or appearance by AV from the jail or on the phone, whatever the case may be, I think it needs the participation of the defendant, of the accused.
In other words, let me just speak. You need a presence before the court. Is that
sure.
what you're saying?
Sure.
Whether it's telephonically or physically in person, you need a presence before
sure.
it attaches.
Yes, and I would allow that if a suspect were arrested without a warrant and immediately hired a lawyer because they had the means to do so, and the in a county where they do the Riverside Gerstein process in person, and that lawyer went with, you know, on behalf of the suspect, I think that would be kind of an edge case where I think you could say that yes, you have an appearance. Mr. Robinson's brief talks about the different ways that you can have an appearance. You can file a letter or have an attorney go for you. I agree, you can. None of that happened here. And none of it does happen through the use of the CR 215. So when you look at how frequently the court in Rothgary discusses the significance of the initial appearance or the significance of the first appearance, it has to mean something, and the task is to sort of tease out what that is. Now, going back to Justice Hagedorn's question earlier about the Wisconsin statutes, this is where we get into kind of the term of art, because I do acknowledge that Rothgary doesn't mean the initial appearance per Wisconsin statute, whatever. And so similarly, I think that to the extent that there's some conflict between the setting of bail, that the setting of bail in the form CR 215 would indicate this is an initial appearance under that statute, I think it goes both ways. You don't also have, it doesn't necessarily trigger the initial appearance within the meaning of Rothgary just because the court does something that the Wisconsin statutes say happens at the initial appearance. Because I think if you're relying on that, then you have to say that it's the statutory initial appearance and that there's just a problem with the fact that bail is being set on the CR 215. So I want to talk a little bit about we talked about restrictions on liberty. Okay, so the
let me ask if let me inquire of you, counsel.
Okay.
If we find the law is not well settled, this court split 3-3, that is arguably some indicia of the settlement of the law, why shouldn't we just improvidently grant this and let the Seventh Circuit handle it?
I don't want to speak for the court on that or for the members
no,
of the court on that point.
Don't worry. Put that to the bottom of your worry list.
I will say that when I took over this case and I learned that it was a certification and that it was an ineffective assistance of counsel case, I was surprised that certification was granted. But I went with it, and you know, at that point, it was that horse had left the barn, so to speak. I would say that, as I mentioned before, I think the government, the state, does want an answer on this question. I mean, I think, for better or worse, right or wrong, I think we want to be able to let Milwaukee County know and all the other counties in the state know what procedure has to happen, and if that means that the CR 215 needs to be modified to remove the setting of bail, then perhaps that can move forward. But I think an improvident grant in this case, it's going to end up back here. I mean, we'll end up back here in a couple of years having the same conversation, I'm sure. So,
Counsel, could you give a quick summary for our benefit, or at least my benefit, of exactly what you would want this court to say? Obviously, we need to be mindful of the fact, on the merits of this, putting aside the ineffective assistance counsel and those other considerations for a moment, if we were to substantively answer the question, that this form, the right to counsel, does not attach because. Can you put it in 3-4 sentences that is mindful as we need to be that whatever we say would be interpreted and applied in every other county in the state?
So hopefully if the opinion were to say this, it would be clear. I think that you begin by noting that there are multiple ways to get to the attachment of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. You say that there one way to do that is the formal criminal complaint, that the form CO215 is not formal enough to constitute the formal criminal complaint, that then you have to get into what other ways can the right to counsel attach besides the formal criminal complaint, and then you look at the factors that run throughout Rothgary, which are the initial appearance before the judge or the first appearance before a judge or a court commissioner, the defendant being notified of the charges against him or her, and restrictions being placed on liberty. And I think that comes back to clarify sort of how Rothgary fits into that. That comes back to you're always going to have restrictions on liberty when there's been a warrantless arrest.
But I'm hearing you say, did you have another question, Justice?
Go ahead, Justice.
But I'm hearing you say, or at least I thought what you said earlier in the argument, is that part of that notification is an in-person or appearance appearing by video or something like that.
Right.
Is that part of what you would ask us?
Yes. I think the notice to the defendant, right, it needs to be manageable. And I would say that the form being distributed via either prison mail or hand-delivered, we don't really know. There's nothing in the record about when Mr. Robinson received this form, how he received this form, if he ever did receive this form. There's nothing in the record stating all of that, and that shows sort of the evidentiary problems with that. So I do think that the notice to the suspect, the notice to the accused, needs to be practically speaking in person. If there is some other way that could happen that I'm not thinking of, then perhaps. But I do think that you need to have a notice to the accused component that is not going to bog the courts down in these evidentiary quagmires.
So I hear three, I just want to make sure I got three things basically were some sort of first appearance.
Yes.
Method means to be debated, but some sort of first appearance, some sort of notification, and restrictions on liberty. Is that kind of your three points that you would wish us to say?
That is the way that I read Rothgary. I think that's consistent with Rothgary. I think that's consistent with Brewer and Jackson and Kirby underpinning Rothgary. And you know, ideally, what I would want the court to be able to say, I think, is sort of Justice Kurowski expressed some confusion at this about, you know, not having prosecutorial involvement. I mean, that makes the most sense to me, but I do think that the Supreme Court kind of closed that door. I think Rothgary is kind of a quirky opinion in that way, and so kind of working with Rothgary and what it actually says, I think those are the three things that it says gets you there without a formal criminal complaint.
Well, you also said that you think that it needs some involvement of the accused in the process.
Yeah.
And with the CR-212, there's no involvement of the accused.
Right. I think the involvement of the accused, and if I may finish my thought briefly, I think the involvement of the accused goes to the first appearance or the initial appearance. I think that's what we're talking about there. So thank you very much.
So under your argument, counsel, what's the difference between a Riverside paper review hearing non-hearing, really, because it's a paper review, and an initial appearance?
So my argument is that for the purpose of satisfying the attachment inquiry under Rothgary, Riverside hearing, when it's coupled with the bail or the restrictions on liberty, however we want to define that, that is an initial appearance for determining when count.
If the court here would not have set bail, then it would not be an initial appearance.
I think arguably, yes. It's unclear. Again, Rothgary gave us those three requirements. It said if you meet these three requirements, you've got it.
I'm trying to figure out whether Riverside reviews, which at least my experience had been, you know, someone arrested Friday night, and they need to have some sort of review before Monday, right? Or if it's a holiday weekend, before Tuesday. Because we don't have the courthouse open round the clock in Washington County, so we would do reviews on paper of whether or not someone's properly sitting in jail. And I'm trying to figure out whether that even ever exists anymore without the right to counsel attaching.
So it obviously would still exist. The only question for the court would be whether that procedure, if it's conducted in this fashion, triggers the attachment of a right to counsel. It doesn't mean that the procedure's changed or that the person gets counsel at that stage.
Would you agree that traditionally Riverside-type paper reviews did not mean that the right to counsel attached?
So in Rothgary, which is a Riverside, the Article 15.17 hearing under Texas law, that is a Riverside procedure. That is a probable cause procedure.
You can have in court, in person, Riverside review, but sometimes you don't, right? I mean, sometimes you just don't. So that's what I'm talking about. Again, I'm just trying to be practical for how this would work for the person arrested Friday night who 48 hours passes before the courthouse even opens again. How does it work? You're saying the right to counsel attaches in Riverside now.
The right to counsel attaches if the Riverside procedure that's conducted has those three components.
After, correct? They don't have a right to an attorney at the Riverside. I think
exactly.
That might be the confusion. After they do the Riverside, then for anything critical after, it would attach, right?
That's correct. And I think that's Justice Alito and the Chief Justice's concurrence to Rothgary. I think if we look at that concurrence, it addresses that concern. And so I think one other thing...
Was that in Riverside, though, anywhere?
I'm sorry?
I'm trying to figure out how it works as a practical reality. Was the right to counsel in Riverside?
So there's no dispute that you do not have the right to an attorney at your Riverside hearing. I think the court clearly said that in Koch. I think the other interesting thing that's falling out of this is we have the state taking this position that personal appearance is so important. It seems a little bit to me like the rug is being pulled out from defendants because we've already told people starting in 1993 with State versus Koch that appearance is not necessary to satisfy the Fourth Amendment requirement of a Riverside hearing. It's perfectly fine to conduct these figurative appearances, and that's what we've been doing. Suddenly, when it comes to the Sixth Amendment attachment inquiry, the personal appearance has become dispositive. And at least for me, the state has not been able to articulate why that difference should exist between the Fourth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment rights in this sense. Possibly it is, if the state's correct. I don't know. Have Riverside proceedings been incorrectly done? Do we need to look again at the language assessed in Koch? Where, again, in Koch, what this court was assessing was similar language from Riverside. You need to be brought before. This court had no difficulty saying brought before doesn't really mean brought before. Doesn't mean somebody actually has to physically take you into a courtroom. It simply means that there's this procedure. And that is, I think, the direct genesis for the CR-215 procedure that we're assessing in this case. I just don't think that personal appearance can be the dispositive inquiry. I think we need to look carefully at what actually happened here. We have a person who's arrested, who's placed in the Milwaukee County Jail. We have an agent of the state who swears out an affidavit. I'm sorry, I see that my time is up.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
Indicating that this person violated specified criminal offenses and attaches police reports to substantiate that, and a judicial officer determines that they probably did it. I think that attaches at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for interesting oral argument. For conference at 1 o'clock.